Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello and welcome to Idle Chatter. Ray Bohax here, your host, coming to you from Cat Swamp Road in Hackettstown, New Jersey, also known as the Hot Rod Farmer. Well, today is a rainy day here, and we had about an inch of rain overnight, and it's a little bit chilly. It's 39 degrees, so it's just on the verge of having a little bit of snow, and we're supposed to have that later in the week. So I guess the fall and winter season is starting to come upon us here. I know in many parts of the country that you've had a lot of snow already, and hey, better you than me. That doesn't sound too Christian, right? But I know a lot of guys still have crops in the field, and having that snow in the cold weather is really not that good, so I don't mean to make light of that. But hopefully you're having a blessed day and the things are going well. And I just want to thank you for listening to my podcast today, Idle Chatter. And hopefully you're listening to it on the Fran Network. And I always like to repeat this every week because there's new listeners coming on board every week, which I'm very grateful for. So my podcast is available on the Fran Network, which is the Farm and Rural Ag Network, along with a lot of other podcasts. I think there's 8 or 9 more, and in addition to mine, there may be 10 with mine. And also it is available at Ag Daily, which they have a number of different podcasts there also listed and housed. And you could also listen to it on my website, which is farmmachinerydigest.com. So we currently have 3 ways for you to listen. So check it all out. And also do not forget to come to my website, because as I always like to say, that there's a lot of other information there beyond the podcast. And one of the things that are on the website and also being published every month in the Ag Now magazine, which is part of the Fran Network, is my toolbox test. And I really enjoy creating those tests, and hopefully you guys enjoy taking them. And that is our talk today for this podcast is going to be from one of the questions in the toolbox test, because what I've seen with the results that are coming back to me, that a good majority of people get this wrong, and it has to do with warming up an engine. Any engine, with warming it up. So we're going to discuss that today, but there's a few things I want to go over with you first, is that we'll be coming upon the Christmas season, a blessed time of year with the birth of our Savior, Jesus Christ. And as tradition goes, people like to exchange gifts. So what I decided to do is I am going to start the first annual, and hopefully, God willing, there'll be many more than one, the first annual gift guide. And what I am calling it is What to Get the Hot Rod Farmer in Your Life for Christmas or any other time. So what I'm going to do is have a special podcast, a short podcast of probably about 15 minutes or so, and I'm going to be theme it off of the 12 days of Christmas. So there's going to be 12 different gift ideas for the hot rod farmer guy or gal in your life. And then I'm also going to supplement that with a little article on my website, so you could see a picture of all of the potential gift ideas, and also a link to the company's website. so you could find out more about it and how to purchase it if you do choose to. So I'm excited about that because I know oftentimes people struggle to get a loved one a gift, and if they are a hot rod farmer, then these are gifts that I'm sure that they will really, really embrace and be very grateful that you got for them. And then if you're not a hot rod farmer, there'd probably be no way for you to even know that these things exist. So there'll be a different price points from stocking stuffers to maybe something that you want to chip in with a couple other family members and get the hot rod farmer in your life this really great or more costly gift. So check it out. I'm hoping to have that up just before Thanksgiving, so around November 21st, and that will run. That podcast will be an inventory in all three places, and the article will be on the website until Christmas. So what I would suggest for you to do is maybe make a suggestion to someone to check that out once it's up, and then they could also go to the website and hopefully get you one of those gifts if you are a hot rod farmer, which I'm sure that you are if you are listening to this. But that will be in addition to the normal weekly Idle Chatter podcast. There will not be in lieu of it. So keep your eyes and ears peeled for that, and I think that you will find that there are some really neat gift ideas up there. I know there's things up there that I would like to have. So hint, hint, Charlotte, to my wife, maybe she'll listen to this podcast. So listen, let's get down to work today. And one of the questions that I have in one of the toolbox tests, I don't honestly remember, there's four up there right now. I create a new toolbox test every month along with a new editorial column called Flags Across the Harvest. And so there's four toolbox tests up there now, and the fifth will be up in December. So I really didn't start this podcast or this website till after we got done with Harvest. It was up there, but it really was not publicized, and I wanted to build inventory. So truly, as far as I'm concerned, the starting date for all of this is October 1st, but there are podcasts and articles on the website dating back to July, or the end of June, when we were actually formulating the website. I wanted to have enough inventory that when people did come to it, it would not just be an empty shelf. And also, if you get a chance to go to the website, there's two new articles under the Getting to Know series. And that is about why you may need to use an adjustable flow rate PCV valve, positive crankcase ventilation system, on one of your older gasoline engines, an old farm truck, what have you. And the other article that is up there is about this really neat, they'll call it an apparatus, for lack of better terms. It's called the hose end connector, and it's to allow thermal expansion in the hydraulic system of an implement or attachment that is off the tractor or a skid steer loader or what have you. And just check that out. If you ever had trouble hooking something back up the hydraulic lines after the implement or the attachment sat for a while, that will give you the answer. And I know I've had that issue with a brand new tractor. So, and I use the hose end connector, and it works great. So check that out. It's under the Getting to Know series, both the PCV valve article and the hose end connector. And it's really good. You know, it's good for you guys to be able to look at this, and because the more you know, the more intimate you become with things, the more efficient you will be in the farm shop. So, as I said, check it out, read it, and leave a comment if you like. And if you have any interest, just link to those companies, and they could give you more information. So, I want you to know that I endorse these products because I've used them, but there's no financial gain on my part from that whatsoever. I just want to convey some good different, I don't know if I say parts or apparatus or whatever the word would be. Some, as I find something that I think is good, I like to be able to tell you guys about it. But anyway, getting back to this question on one of my toolbox tests about whether an engine should be warmed up or not, I would have to say probably 60 to 70% of the people get that wrong, and they feel that an engine should be warmed up. And I'm going to explain to you why that is incorrect. And I just want you to stay with me on this, because you may be getting your dander up already, saying that hot rod farmer's nuts. We always have to warm up an engine. Well, first of all, like anything in life, in history, you have to go backwards, because you can't go forwards unless you go backwards and see what everything is about. My dad used to say, God rest his soul, you can't win the war if you don't know what the battle is about. So, back years ago, prior to diesel engines and everything was gasoline powered, if the carburetor was not set properly, and then subsequently the choke, automatic choke, was not set properly, and most farm equipment did not have an automatic choke, they had a hand choke, but cars and pickup trucks eventually had automatic chokes. But if the choke circuit was not set properly and the carburetor was not set properly, a gasoline engine would be very bulky to keep running, and to specifically to drive away when it was cold. And the reason for that being is that gasoline has a very poor rate of vaporization when the engine is cold and when the air is cold. And because of that poor vaporization, the engine did not run properly and would not take a load properly. It would either buck or stall or a combination of both. So due to that, people got into the habit of believing that an engine needs to be warmed up. Now, as an aside to that, if you had an engine with a hand choke, or you had an engine with an automatic choke, we'll go with the automatic choke first. We'll go backwards that way. If the automatic choke spring tension and the fast idle, which they work hand in hand, the fast idle and the spring tension, were set properly, then you would be able to start that car, that truck, what have you, start that engine, and put a load on it and drive away immediately. If it's not set properly, then that engine will be bulky and not want to drive away until it builds some heat. And once it builds heat, there'll be a greater percentage of the fuel vaporized, turning to a vapor. Now, with a hand choke would be the same thing. If you had an engine with a hand choke and you knew how to modulate that choke so you could just open it up slightly and still leave a little bit of a restriction so the carburetor pulls more fuel until it warmed up, you would be able to take that tractor or that truck, if it was a truck or a car with a hand choke on it, and you would be able to drive it away. And as the engine started to build heat, you would push that choke lever in and you would cancel some of that amount of enrichment until there was no additional enrichment whatsoever. It was this, for the same reason, for the vaporization of the fuel. So people got the wrong idea. They thought that the engine needed to be warmed up, but it really was not the engine needed to be warmed up. It was because you did not have the choke set properly to give it the proper air-fuel ratio for the load condition you were going to put on it. And when it came to a diesel engine had a little bit of a different scenario because it didn't truly have a choke. Some injection pumps did have a cold setting on them that would be evoked and would give the engine a little bit more fuel and also raise the idle speed up when the engine was cold. But since a diesel actually injected the fuel right into the older diesels, into a pre-chamber, and then the later diesels right into the combustion chamber. Pre-chamber being indirect injection, and then the later modern ones being direct injection. But into the pre-chamber is that it was injecting the fuel into the combustible region, which was a lot hotter than a carburetor trying to atomize fuel vaporize fuel in the intake manifold. So the diesel was injecting it right into the combustion region. But also, they could be a little bit bulky when they were cold, but not to the extent that a gasoline engine would be. But what we're going to be talking about today, warming up or not warming up, holds true for both gasoline and diesel, but a lot of my emphasis will make examples upon the gasoline engine in the beginning now. So, if you turn the clock back to around the late 1970s, I was a young kid, and I remember reading in one of the farm magazines, I don't remember if it was Successful Farming or Farm Journal at the time. I don't think we got Progressive Farmer back then, but anyway, that was International Harvester, IH, way long before they joined with Case. They did a study, and they found out that there was approximately 1,200% more wear in an engine when it was cold than when it was warm. And what would happen is this would be a sliding scale. So as soon as the engine started, the first minute or two of operation, it could have been 1,300% more wear. And then as the engine started to build heat, this would ramp down. But in essence, the number that they published, I think it was like 1,136 or 1,186% more wear when an engine is cold than when it is warm. And where does this wear come from? Well, this wear comes from a number of different regions. Is that when the parts are cold, they shrink in dimension, so the clearances are different, and also the oil in the crankcase did not get up, does not flow as easily when it is cold than when it is warm, and offers and provides a lack of lubrication in many key areas, specifically around where the piston rings ride on the cylinder bore. And then, but the whole engine basically is, I don't want to say the word is starved for lubrication, but has a minimal amount of lubrication when the engine is cold due to the clearances. And then, so we have the additional friction of the clearances being tight, and we also have the problem of the oil, the lubricant, the lifeblood of the engine not getting to the proper places or in enough insufficient volume to provide protection. So if you were to just hear that, you would say, well, that flies in contrast to what I'm saying, is that you don't want to load the engine because you don't want it to have excessive wear when it is cold. But the thing that you need to remember about this or recognize is that when an engine is idling, it builds very little heat, and it builds heat very slowly. So what basically happens is that you're exposing an idling engine to a long period of time of excessive wear. So the bearings, all the clearances, the bearing clearances, the valve clearances, the piston, the cylinder wall clearance, the rings, the clearances in the camshaft, the cam bearings, when you idle an engine from a cold start, it builds heat very slowly. And so all of those parts are experiencing excessive wear during that time. So the goal basically is to shorten or hasten the amount of time that the excessive wear is happening. Now, how can you do this? You cannot do this by idling, because the rate of thermal excursion or the rate of thermal transfer is very slow. So the way you do it is by starting the engine, and as soon as it builds oil pressure, if it has an oil pressure light, then as soon as that goes off, or if it has an oil pressure gauge, basically in essence, as soon as the engine starts, it's going to have full oil pressure. And if it doesn't, you have other problems, is that you want to drive away this engine, or you want to put a slight load on it. Because if you put a slight load on it, it will build heat quicker, because it has to make more power. And in any engine, any internal combustion engine is a heat engine. It converts chemical energy to mechanical energy. So let's say arguably, and I'm going to throw arbitrary numbers at you with this. So let's say it's 20 degrees outside. and you go outside and you start the engine. The engine is at ambient temperature. It sat all night. The oil is at 20 degrees. All the parts in the engine block were at 20 degrees. The crankshaft is at 20 degrees. The oil is at 20 degrees. The coolant is at 20 degrees. Everything is what we would call normalized at 20 degrees at the ambient temperature. So now you start the engine and you let it idle. There is not any load on the engine when it is idling, so thus it uses very little fuel, even though if it has some sort of enrichment circuit on, and builds a very little temperature, because temperature and heat are produced when the engine is making power. You could have a 500 horsepower engine, there are 500 horsepower diesel in a combine, and when it's idling, it probably makes about 10 horsepower. So it only has the heat being generated for 10 horsepower for the amount of power that the engine is making at that particular point. So what will happen is that, let's say arguably after 2 minutes, that instead of the oil in the block being at 20 degrees, we said it was 20 degrees outside, that it is now at 40 degrees. Well, yes, that's better, but still not that great. So let's say 8 minutes, it may be at 60 degrees or 70 degrees. And if it's a large diesel engine, that block has a lot of mass to it. And that mass becomes what's called cold soaked, that because anything that has a lot of mass to it will either absorb a lot of heat or absorb a lot of cold. So we use the term within the industry, heat soaked and cold soaked. So if you were to have that engine that's cold soaked and it has a lot of physical mass to it, a lot of weight to it, is that it's going to take a very long time for that heat to transfer into those components. And if you're not building heat at a high rate, it would be like trying to boil a cup of water with a cigarette lighter. Eventually you will get there, but it takes a long time because the cigarette lighter does not have enough BTU of heat, British thermal units of heat energy, which is a caloric value, to quickly raise that temperature of the water in the cup to make it boil. So if you stayed there for 3 days with the cigarette lighter, is that you eventually get it to boil, but it would take a very long time versus putting it on a stove that has a high amount of BTU. So using that same theory, is that you want to be able to accelerate or minimize the amount of time that engine is seeing excessive wear. Now, as I said in the beginning of this discussion, is that the wear goes down, the amount of wear goes down as the heat is brought up, but it doesn't go down in a linear fashion. So at a certain oil temperature, the wear may start to drop 150% or 30% or 40%, so it doesn't go from 1100% wear down to 1099, 1098, 999. It goes down in steps as the parts start to expand, and even though the part may expand in a linear function, is that it's more digital the way that the amount of wear drops off, because once you start to open up those clearances and get the oil to everything, then things start to change very quickly. So the problem being is that if you let an engine idle, you're bringing it up to temperature very slowly and you're exposing it to a great amount of wear for a longer, what we would call an engineering duty cycle. So the amount of time that it's running, that it is cold, is longer than if you were to put a slight load on it. So what is a slight load? Well, if it is a road vehicle, a car or a truck, you would want to start the engine and then drive it away with very light throttle. And get out on the road, accelerate slowly and get it up to speed, and then you will see that it builds temperature very quickly and that it will now reduce the amount of wear. If it's a diesel engine on a road vehicle, it would be the same scenario. But if it's a piece of farm equipment like a tractor or a combine or what have you, depending upon the application, you will either drive that. So you could take the tractor and start to drive it slowly to the field. If it's a combine, you could start to drive it, or you could engage the header, and you want to let it work a little bit to be able to build heat quicker. Now, keep in mind also that if you idle an engine, and will a car, a passenger vehicle, pickup truck car is probably a better example for this. So let's say that you go and you start, it's 20 degrees outside, whatever number you want to sign outside, it's cold, and you start the engine up, and you go back in the house, and you come out 10 minutes later, and oh, now the engine is warm, and the heater is starting to produce heat. And you say, oh, this is great, I'm wonderful, now I'm going to get out in the road, and I'm going to go like heck, right? Well, keep in mind that by idling the engine, you had very little thermal transfer into the transmission. You've had some, so the transmission is very cold, and that excessive amount of wear is happening there. The wheel bearings are cold because they're not moving. The differential is cold. The universal joints are cold. And even the suspension parts are cold because they're not moving up and down. The shocks are cold. The ball joints are cold. The tie rods are cold. They're all at ambient temperature. So by you driving that vehicle away lightly, with light load, not getting it and whacking it to the floor, light load, you are not only warming the engine up quicker and reducing drastically the amount of wear, but you are also at the same time warming up the transmission, warming up the drivetrain, warming up the brakes, the wheel bearings, the pivots and the suspension and what have you. So it is a much smarter way to do this, and you will also, for your own benefit, you will build heat a lot sooner in the passenger compartment because the engine is warming up quicker. Now, we had discussed this also in the previous podcast, I don't recall which one, is that when on a liquid-cooled engine, when the thermostat is closed, what is happening is that you are running the coolant, you are bypassing the radiator and keeping the coolant in the block. And once the thermostat starts to open, you are now putting the coolant through the radiator. If you were to have too high an engine speed when the engine is cold, you and the thermostat is closed, then you will actually cavitate that water pump, and over time that you will compromise that seal and that water pump will start to leak. And that is why it is so important that I say not only do you want to not stress the engine by going too fast or too much of a load when it's cold, but you want to be able to not have to have too high an RPM reached for that water pump, so while it's still feeding the coolant through the bypass circuit of the engine, or of the cooling system, I should say. I don't want to use the word cooling system twice in a sentence, but this is a casual discussion, so I will do that. So when that thermostat is closed, all the coolant is going through the bypass circuit. Once that thermostat starts to open, it starts to send some coolant to the radiator. So it is imperative that the engine is not racing while you're putting it under terribly high, at it, exposing it to a very, very high RPM, but you're driving it away easily. And, you know, this holds true to not only liquid-cooled engines, obviously, with the thermostat it does, but if you have, let's say, like a UTV, you have a lawn tractor, you have anything, is that you do not want to let that to sit and idle to temperature. I get on my lawn tractor, I start it up, boom, I drive it away slowly to where I'm going to cut, and once I get to that particular region, then what happens is that I, you know, evoke the PTO and raise the RPM, and I know that by doing that, I'm extending the life of that engine. Now, let's revisit some of this. So this 1,200% number came from International Harvester in the late 1970s. Since then, a number of things have changed. And one of the things that have changed dramatically is the performance of modern engine oil, modern motor oil. If you ever go on Jeopardy and they ask you a question, really the proper term is that it's engine oil, not motor oil. Because an engine is internal combustion, and a motor is either electric or hydraulic, has no combustion. So even though we use the term motor oil or use the term motor and engine interchangeably, and the actual engineering definition is that an engine so has combustion. So years ago, they would say it's a steam engine. They didn't say it's a steam motor. They'd say it's a gasoline engine, it's a diesel engine, it's a turbine engine. And then when it comes to the term motor, is that really the proper definition, is that it's operated without internal combustion. So a hydraulic motor works through the movement of the hydraulic fluid. An electric motor works through the movement of the electrons spinning the armature. So, but the industry for some reason calls it motor oil, not engine oil. And it's just something, I guess, that stuck from years ago. But the motor oils, engine oils, whatever you want to call them today, are so much better and have so much better flow characteristics than they did back when International Harvester did that test. So today, on a modern piece of equipment that has a different type of oiling system, the modern theory on engine oiling system is exact opposite of what it was years ago. Just like years ago, we used to think that it was best to turn the soil, to plow it, not realizing that, yeah, it looked great and it was nice and soft and it planted well, but that we were burning up all the carbon, the organic matter in our soil by exposing it to an excessive amount of oxygen. Well, years ago, the theory of engine oiling was to have a high-pressure oil pump. And what that was found is that in most instances that is akin to moldboard plowing. And today the logic is to have a low pressure, high volume oil pump. So the oiling systems on these engines are based upon having lower pressure but pumping more volume of oil. And with today's oil technology, be it, you know, I use synthetic oils. I love synthetic oils. Whatever brand you choose to use is fine. It's up to you. But synthetic oils have a lot of attributes that mineral oil does not have. People get viscosity confused with this. It's not viscosity. It's actually called the pumpability of the oil. And it's the cold pumpability of the oil. And a synthetic oil pumps very easily and moves very easily through the engine and gets to all the critical parts when the engine is cold on initial startup. And that's really important today, especially with a lot of overhead cam engines and even a lot of farm equipment. Big diesels are running overhead cam engines. And you have to realize at that particular point, that camshaft and that valve train is as far away from the oil pan and the oil sump as possible. So it's imperative that we get the oil up to there as quickly as we can to keep those parts lubricated. But the pumpability of modern oils, be it synthetic or mineral oils today, through improved chemistry and refining processes, is greatly, greatly improved over what they had. International Harvester did their testing back in the late 70s. So the synthetic oil will have a better rate of pumpability with the same viscosity. So if it's a 530, 1030, 2050, then a mineral oil would, just due to the process that it's to make it a synthetic. As an aside to this, synthetic oils start out as base oils, as mineral oil, and that they are so modified, they go through a synthesizing process that it changes the molecular structure so much and the shape of the molecules that it is no longer recognized as a mineral oil because it got changed so much. And that's why they call it synthetic, because it goes through a synthesizing process and it changes the molecular structure of it. But they are excellent, excellent as far as their pumpability is concerned, and also to maintain their design characteristics at high temperature. But we're not talking about that today. We're talking about the exact opposite, the cold. So back years ago, when IH did that test and printed that data, there were mineral oils, there was some synthetics, but they were really not used in the agricultural industry or the diesel industry or even to much extent in the auto industry. And that oil had a very poor rate of pumpability back then, and the way they were able to have the oil support the combustion load on the bearings is by making it very thick. Today, we have new technology, so the oil is actually able to move through the engine when it's cold at a much sooner at a much quicker rate and get everything oiled. But still, we do have that same issue of having the parts clearances change from cold, and the oil itself will not be as pumpable at 10 or 20 degrees as it would be at 70 or 80 degrees. So we still do have this starvation period of the tighter clearances and the oil not being able to get there, but it's greatly reduced from that 1979 or test when it was published, I believe 78, 79. So is the number 1200% with a modern engine when it's cold? I would have to say, I don't have any real data, but from my background, I'd have to say it's not 1200%, but I would probably say it's 700 or 800% more wear when it is cold than when it is at full operating temperature. But if you have an older piece of equipment and with the older type of oiling system, the older type of mechanical components, then that 1200% number is probably very real, even though if you put a modern oil in it, even a modern mineral-based oil, is that you will have a greater degree of pumpability. So you may bring that down from 1200% to 1100% or 1000%, but still, whatever the number is moot. The thing is that you have to recognize that there is an excessive amount of wear in every engine when it's cold, and your goal with any engine is to be able to minimize that exposure time of when it is experiencing an excessive amount of wear, and that is by putting a light load on that engine so it builds heat quicker, and as it builds heat and the parts expand and the oil gets flowing to everything, is that the rate of wear drops down dramatically, and once you get near operating temperature, the rate of wear really drops down. I'm not going to say obviously it never goes to zero, because there's always some sort of wear. But another thing I want to discuss is that when the engine is cold, and this is gasoline or diesel, is that you are having a poor rate of vaporization of the fuel. And when you have a poor rate of vaporization, we'll first start with gasoline. When you have a poor rate of vaporization of the fuel and you have an enrichment circuit, be it a choke on a carbureted engine or a cold start enrichment on a fuel injected engine, is that you're putting more fuel into that cylinder than that engine is able to use, simply because it's not converting over to a gaseous state. It's not vaporizing. So it's still in liquid form, albeit in little droplets. And so it's atomized, it's broken down into small little droplets, but it's still in a liquid form. And that liquid fuel actually attaches to the piston and attaches to the rings and to the cylinder wall and washes whatever little oil is there off and exposes that engine to further wear. So what's happening is that part of that 1200% number that IH came up with, was part of it was the oil, part of it was the tighter clearances, but the third leg of the stool was that you have a poor rate of vaporization going from a liquid state to a gaseous state, to what's called a rarefied form. And you had this liquid fuel, these little droplets diluting and washing down the oil off the cylinder wall, which would cause an excessive amount of wear on the piston ring and on the cylinder wall and end up glazing over the cylinder wall and taking away or masking the crosshatch which held the oil. So that is the third most important thing, and that still holds true today, because the rate of vaporization has not changed for gasoline over the years. So if you have a engine and it's seeing a lot of cold starts, let's say it's a UTV you're using on your farm or ranch, and you're starting it cold, you're going a short distance, starting it cold, it's going through all of these cold start cycles, what's going to happen is you're going to end up constantly, for the first few seconds of operation, running that piston ring against that cylinder wall with no lubrication, and then you're also going to, because gravity is going to pull that liquid fuel, those little droplets down into the oil pan, and you're going to be diluting the oil with gasoline, and once you dilute the oil with any amount of gasoline, is that you destroy its lubricity. Its ability to lubricate gets destroyed. So that is why you don't want to let that engine sit in idle, because you don't want that fuel to wash the oil off the cylinder walls and have excessive ring wear. So that is the third component of it that I need for you to understand. And the fourth component of it is that specifically with a gasoline engine, and to a lesser extent with diesel, because of the combustion, the theory of the combustion event and where the fuel is actually sprayed into the cylinder, is that when the engine is cold like that and you have a poor rate of vaporization, is that the cylinder builds a lot of carbon deposits, and it builds carbon deposits on the back of the intake valve, which is called IVD, intake valve deposits, and it builds a high rate of carbon deposits because there's just enough heat for it to start to build carbon, but not for it to truly have a chemical to mechanical energy gas exchange of that fuel. So you build carbon deposits, and an engine that is cold started a lot and an engine that is idle to warm up a lot will have an excessive amount of carbon deposits built over the years, and then that will drastically affect the performance of that engine and its longevity, and also over time will have enough carbon deposits that it will stick the piston ring. So that is not good. So let's recap here. When an engine is cold, we have tighter clearances, we have a lack of lubrication, we have poor vaporization, not atomization, vaporization of the fuel, which now washes the gasoline, washes the oil off the cylinder wall, be it with gasoline or diesel, and then we have that fuel that is actually washing the cylinder wall down, and that is now leaching into the oil and polluting the oil and losing its and destroying its lubricity. So that's what's happening when you're idling an engine to warm up, whether you choose to believe it or not. And the goal is to start the engine as soon as it has oil pressure up, which is basically instantaneously. Take that engine and that, hopefully that driveline, some farm equipment is a little bit more difficult to do. But you know, if you're going into the field, you don't need to start the engine, let the tractor idle on a combine, drive it into the field slowly. Low RPM, you don't want to cavitate the water pump and violate that seal, so low RPM, and you start to go and it'll start to build heat. The temperature will come up inside the passenger compartment, you'll have heat quicker, you'll be on a piece of, let's say like a combine, you'll be warming up the hydraulic oil at the same time to the hydraulic motors, you'll be warming up the wheel bearings. On a transmission, you'll be warming up that fluid. On a road vehicle with a differential, you'll be warming up the differential fluid. Everything is warming up together at one time. It's coming up uniformly in temperature, and you will have a piece of equipment that will not only service you better, but will last so much longer and have a minimal amount of repairs because of the excessive amount of wear that you have eliminated. Now, I have a drag race background, and if you ever went to a drag race, you would see what the guys will do is that in the pits, they will actually start the car up, and they'll put it on jack stands, and they'll run the engine, and they'll run the engine, or shift the gears in transmission, and have the differential spinning so that they warm the whole drivetrain up uniformly. Now, I do want to put some caveats to this. Let's say you happen to have a vehicle and it stays outside, and it's outside and it's covered with ice or snow, and you have to warm that up to get the ice off the windshield. I wouldn't go crazy over this. I mean, if you have to warm it up a couple of times a year due to this, that's not going to have any real adverse effect on the longevity of it. All right, so there are certain circumstances when you will have to do that, but as long as you don't make this a habit, and that's why I'm so against so many of these car companies today, and the cars and pickup trucks are offering a remote starter. And they say, oh, you could start the car up while you're sitting in the house having breakfast, and it keeps the doors locked if you live in the city, and it runs and it puts the heat on, and the engine is warmed up. Well, I cringe when I see those ads, because that's the worst thing in the world for an engine. And if you are habitually doing that, not only are you wasting fuel and polluting the air, but you're creating an excessive amount of wear in that engine. And anybody who's an engineer and an engine guy will tell you that. It may be good for a marketing guy to sell you a pickup truck that you could, you know, sit in your kitchen and with a remote start, warm it up, then come out there so it's nice and warm and the ice is melted off the windshield. But if that engine could speak to you and that driveline, it would say that you're killing it. And that is really not what we want to do. And I want to just break away from this before I close. And I want to just say to you that the whole premise, and I say this so often, that the whole premise of this podcast and my website, the Farm Machinery Digest website, is that I want your farm to be efficient. And I want your farm and ranch to be profitable. And, you know, so many times, all I hear is market-focused decisions, okay? We're talking about what the Chicago Board of Trade is offering for a crop or for cattle or what have you. And I always say this to you, and I'm going to beat this into your head because it's going to be like a broken record. If not every week, it's going to be nearly every week, is that that's only one element of your success. Yes, you owe it to yourself, you owe it to your farm, you owe it to your family to get the most for your crop, be it a grain crop, be it a vegetable crop, be it a livestock crop, what have you. But the other side of the ledger column is your expenditures. And, you know, and I don't see people talking about the money that's being spent. They talk about input costs for their crop, but they don't talk about the machinery costs. And that's really why I started this whole deal, is because, you know, and I've seen this time and time again in other businesses. I mean, in every industry, is that you could see this. If you could have the greatest amount of sales, you could have the greatest amount of gross profitability on your service or widget that you're making and selling. But if you have the back door open, it's all flying out. And I just really want to stress this to anyone who's listening to this, is that it is imperative that you basically run your machine side of your ledger as efficiently as you do your agronomy or animal husbandry side. Because if you could limit the amount of repairs that you have, if you could make a piece of equipment last longer, if you could get better value on a trade-in when you go to sell it, then that's all money that does not need to be earned. And as I always say, it's not what you make, it is what you keep. You could have low crop prices and a very efficient operation, and you could come out great with a very profitable year. Or you could have great crop prices, high yields, and have everything blow up in the shop, and you're basically out of business. And I've said this before. You know, and sadly, I've had exposure to some of the high-yield farmers, and there's nothing that I'm taking away from what they're doing there. But it is, you know, I say, yeah, the guy's got great yield. I'm not going to deny that. I can't accomplish that. But then I go over to his tractor, and or I go over to his combine, I go over to his pickup truck, and, you know, the thing, it's got a lot of issues on it that he very easily could have avoided if he put only one-tenth of the care into that piece of equipment that he did to try to get his yield. And, you know, and the good thing about it is that it's a a lot easier for you to make smart decisions in your farm shop with doing stuff like not warming up your engines, idling to warm up, putting them slightly under load, than it is to try to get high yield out of a crop. So it's a lot easier, and once you get into that mindset, then that's it's fine. You'll do it. It'll be second nature, and you will see that your expenditures in the farm shop will go down dramatically because your downtime on the equipment is going to go down, and you're not going to be forced to be doing repairs that are not necessary. And your whole idea is to make everything last longer, and that doesn't mean you're not going to spend any money, but you're going to invest money. And as I said last year at Commodity Classic, my wife spends money, I invest money. There's a difference. When you spend money, all you do is expect to bring something home with you and get a bill in the mail if you put on a credit card. When you invest money or you invest your time into something, you're investing your time to listen to this podcast. You're investing your time to go on my website and read an article. Is that you expect to glean a return from that. So an investment will give you a return. A purchase or spending money will give you something warm and fuzzy and a bill in the mail. And the thing is that you need to invest, not Excuse me. I'm getting all excited. You need to invest in your farm and in your business. So listen, you have a blessed, blessed day. And I thank you so much for listening. And we didn't do a special delivery segment today because I was running a little bit long. But we will have one next week. But I do want you to know that every time that we do have a special delivery, even when we don't, that it's brought to you by Firestone Ag. It's a company that is founded by Harvey Firestone, a fourth-generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. Harvey dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and his innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today, and lives on with their 23-degree tread bar and AD2 technology. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. So I'm so proud that Firestone is part of this. And I ask you to, when it comes time for tires, you know, please check them out. Because you'd be buying tires from a farmer, from Harvey Firestone, the fourth generation farmer from the heartland in Columbiana, Ohio. So listen, you have a blessed week. And I hope things go well for you. And please know, as I always like to close and say, that I'm honored that you listen to this and visit my website. And the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved, beloved America. So you have a great day, and I will hopefully talk to you next week. Bye.